Hello and welcome to the first in a series of webinars from Savvy Woman. Today we'll be talking about divorce and relationship breakdown, and in particular focusing on the financial aspect of getting divorced, dissolving a civil partnership, or breaking up with your partner. Now I'm joined by two of Savvy Woman's Ask the Expert panel, by David Allison, who's a partner with the law firm Family Law and Partnership. As you may know, Family Law and Partnership is a founder sponsor of Savvy Woman, but more importantly, David is an expert in divorce and also in your rights if you live together. Family Law and Partnership was the first law firm in England to have in-house counsellors and mediators and prides itself on a non-confrontational approach to divorce. Now, also with me is Sarah Killick, and Sarah is an independent financial advisor with the firm FPW. She's a chartered financial planner, which means she's taken more exams than most independent financial advisors. And Sarah specialises in pensions, retirement, saving and investing. If you'd like to ask a question you've dialed in on the phone, you can just press star 2 to raise your hand and I'll be able to take your question. Now, I've already had a number of questions that have come in by email from women who aren't able to listen live but who will catch the webinar afterwards. So before we have any questions coming in on the phone, I'd just like to ask you, David and Sarah, about some of the issues that come up when couples are thinking of getting divorced or are breaking up. David, I'll ask you first. One of the questions that I think you've been asked a lot through the Ask the Expert section on Savvy Woman is, will everything we own be split 50-50 when we get divorced? What is the situation and is that the case?
Yes, it is something that we get asked a lot. You're absolutely right. It may be the answer in some cases, but as I guess with all of these things, it isn't quite that straightforward. The starting point may be to look at what's been built up during the relationship and then to see what the outcome will be if you divided that down the middle. But there are a whole host of factors that we'd need to look at. And most importantly, needs of the couple and their children. So if you've got a situation where, say, there's young children who are living, as often is the case, are staying with their mother, then often she will need more of the capital so that she's able to buy a property with a small or no mortgage, so that she can house the children, whereas the husband may well have an income, or hopefully he has an income and therefore a mortgage capacity, so he's able to raise a mortgage to acquire his property. So it isn't quite that straightforward, although ignoring needs, which of course you can't do, the 50-50 may well be a starting point.
And so you've mentioned the situation in terms of divorce. Quite different, though, if you're just living with your partner, as in you're not in a civil partnership, you're not married, you are living together, and then you break up. Are there any kind of hard and fast rules about who gets what? Or is it down to sort of how you own, you know, who put the money into the joint account, who put the money into the house, etc.?
Yeah, bizarrely, English law treats people who live together outside of marriage or civil partnership in a very, very different way to those who are married or in a civil partnership. The law effectively ignores those sort of personal relationships. And so if your relationship does break down, you don't have, there are no claims that you can make simply as a consequence of the relationship, which of course puts some people in really quite difficult financial circumstances. You can imagine if you've had a sort of traditional tight relationship where one of the couple has given up work and brought up the children, cooked and cleaned and done all that sort of stuff, she, as it usually is, doesn't get any credit for that. The only way she can potentially make a claim against the chap that she's lived with is if there's an agreement that she should share in a particular piece of property, usually a house, or that can be inferred from the circumstances. And she's, you know, normally would have had to rely to her detriment upon, you know, that agreement or understanding. But those claims are quite difficult, the law really does need to change in this respect and get into the 21st century, frankly.
And when you said that there either could be an agreement that she'd benefit from, say, the value of a house or whatever, or that it can be inferred from the circumstances, I mean, does it mean that couples who live together, they actually have to have something written down in paper, or can it be something less formal?
certainly better if they've got something in writing, because that's very clear. And
yeah,
of course, if you've got
something
in writing, yeah, that's it. You know, it's very difficult to challenge it. But no, it's not necessary for something to be in writing. Often people will rely on discussions that they've had. So, and of course, many years earlier when things were a lot happier, they have to show that what the intention was that they would both benefit in this property. And that can be all sorts of things, really. It could be that, you know, the one whose name isn't on it has made, excuse me, a financial contribution. And it could be that there's a discussion about the home always belonging to both of them, you know, something informal like that.
And that would be enough, just sort of a conversation saying, you know, this is our home and not just my home. I mean, would that be enough, or would that be quite hard to argue?
It's probably difficult if it's just, you know, just that once it's been said, because what the court would do in those cases that do fight is sort of look at the whole history of it, see what hear the evidence of the discussions, look at how they dealt with their lives, whether they shared bank accounts, whether, you know, the person who's making a claim is acted to their detriment in reliance on the agreement in inverted commas. So that it would look at a whole host of you know, the factors and the history of the entire relationship, which is why these claims can be particularly difficult, because it's difficult to predict until you actually hear the evidence what a court's likely to do. So if you can avoid those, actually going to court on those claims, it's all very much for the better.
And Sarah, couples who are married or in a civil partnership have been able to divide any pension they have at the time of divorce for quite a long time, over 10 years. But the focus is often on the family home, it seems. But how important can the pension be as an asset when you're getting divorced?
Well, of course, it depends whereabouts you're based. In the southeast, properties can be extremely expensive. But in many cases, especially if someone's been in a company scheme for a number of years, the pension fund may actually be a bigger asset than the family home. And long term, it can be of more value. People tend to want the family home or cash because they can see it now. I've sometimes heard that referred to as a utility kind of argument, that cash is more valuable. But actually, if you haven't had much history of being employed or haven't been in a pension scheme, it's quite difficult to build up substantial pension benefits. And if you're looking at your retirement plans, even though people still think pensions are poor value for money or whatever, it is actually difficult to convert capital to income, and a pension is still a very effective way of doing that, even though we see annuity rates are terrible. So an annuity is still a fairly effective way to generate income, and it is difficult, and very difficult, to build up a significant pension pot if you haven't got a lot of income and if you're not working.
And an annuity, basically, so if you're not in a final salary or salary-related pension, that's the product that you buy to convert your sort of lump sum, your pot, into income.
Yes, yeah. So when you're either going to be in a company pension where you're getting a proportion of your final salary, essentially, for each year you've worked, so that's guaranteed and nothing really can go wrong with that, or you've got a big pot of money, or not a big pot of money, and you have to go and use that pot of money to buy yourself an income, and you choose at the time what kind of income you want from that. But it's all based on the open market and annuity rates or long-term gilt rates at the time. So it's quite, difficult to judge a long-term in advance what those rates are going to be.
Okay. And so what, in very basic terms, and this is sort of a question for both of you really, are the ways that a pension can be taken into account or divided during divorce?
Pensions, as being said, are really important, and they certainly need to be taken into account. There's something that can too easily get ignored because, you know, they're a long way off and not so tangible. But they are important. They can be dealt with in a number of ways. You can divide a pension by way of a pension sharing order so that part of the pension pot is actually carved out and put into a scheme either with the same provider or with a different provider for the other spouse.
And that's done at the time. That's done at the time you get divorced. It's not done sort of years down the line.
That's right. I mean, it has to be an order for a pension share, mm-hmm. so you need to get an order within the divorce process that does that. The pot is divided at that point, as you say, and then so that then people can either invest or not in, in their separate pots until they come to retirement. So that's the sort of first and, I guess, the most obvious way of dealing with things. Sometimes people want to offset. They'll take a view that perhaps they want to have a house rather than money that is going to come in the future. And so many cases you're looking at trying to compare the two. The difficulty with that is that they are very, it's very difficult to compare a pension with other assets. It's a bit sort of like comparing apples and pears, really. A pension pot clearly is something that can only be accessed at retirement. And then, of course, you get your 25% lump sum and a taxable income. Trying to give that a value as against cash is quite difficult, and often we'll get an actuary involved to tell us what the appropriate figure is. Actually, even when you're dividing pension, often we need to get an actuary in because we need to know actually what division will create a quality of income, because simply splitting the pension down the middle and giving each of them an equal fund doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get the same income from it for all sorts of reasons, and, you know, principally because women are expected to live longer than us chaps, but there are a whole host of other factors that a scheme actuary would take into account.
So those are two ways, and what's the third way that a pension could be sorted out or split when you get divorced?
You can earmark a pension. That's done less often these days. What happens with earmarking, again, it's an earmarking order, so that when the person who has the pension fund receives it, a proportion of it has to be paid over to the other spouse. It's less frequently used since we've had pension sharing. It is, though, sometimes a good way of doing things if, for example, you've got someone who's got a defined benefit pension and the scheme...
And the defined benefit pension, that's the one where you know the amount you get is linked to your salary, so you sort of know what you're going to get.
Yes, usually it's on a final salary type basis. Yeah. Now, those are really very good schemes. Often those schemes are keen to get rid of as many claimants or, you know, pensioners as possible because they're expensive to maintain. So sometimes they'll insist that the person who's taking the share actually invests it with a normal pension provider, one of the pension policy types. Now, if they do that, the likelihood is that the transfer value, and Sarah will know more about this than I, is going to the benefits that you get from it are going to be considerably less valuable than with the defined benefit scheme. So in those circumstances, so there's an overall loss of benefits. So in those circumstances, earmarking can be a good way at least of preserving those benefits.
Okay. Well, we've had our first question, so we'll go to that. And it's one, I think, for you, David, which is it's from Laurie, and she wants to know, does inherited money from parents have to be divided between husband and wife when divorcing, or does it remain with the person who inherited the money?
Again, a very good question. And the answer is again, I'm afraid, not entirely straightforward. Certainly inherited and gifted money, so money that's come in either through inheritance or gifted usually from family, isn't looked at it the same way. So whereas I said earlier that a starting point may well be to look at what's been built up during the marriage and divide it by two, that assumption doesn't apply in relation to gifted and inherited property. Albeit that the longer ago that you received it, the less easy it is to exclude it. But in every case, what importantly we need to look at is what the couple needs. And you can certainly have cases where, again, say, you know, traditional family unit, and say the husband, everything he has been inherited. Clearly, particularly if there are children, the wife is going to need to have a house and for them. And if the only capital is inherited, then the only way she can get that is through the inherited capital. And that's what the court would do. So it's not automatically in the pot, but it's there if it's needed and would be utilised if it's needed.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Sarah, I think there's, you know, splitting up from your husband or partner and making long-term financial decisions is difficult at a time when there's so much emotion going on. But what would you advise women to think about in terms of kind of where they start and how they prioritise what they do?
When you're in this, in that kind of situation, it is going to be very difficult. You need to try and think clearly about, as best you can, what your position will be post-divorce compared to how it is at the current time, and see if you can. And the most important thing, which sounds quite basic, is to try and budget as far as you can to see, you know, what your outgoings will be post-divorce, what will have ceased, what will still be ongoing, and also what your housing costs are going to be, or likely to be. You might need your solicitor to help you there if you're not quite sure where it's going to land. So you're just thinking about what your needs will be post-divorce compared to now, and that's just the basic budgeting. So looking through, I would recommend look through your bank statement, see what goes in and out in terms of utility bills, and see what, and know what your income is going to be post-divorce. And then if you can, really as part of the whole process, you really need to try and think forwards and think, you know, when you, would you have paid your, if you've got a mortgage continuing, would you have paid that off? And in retirement, when you stop working, when income ceases, or when the children, when any maintenance ceases, how you will budget going forward. So there's different income points, aren't there, to see. So just work your head around those points. And then you'll feel more confident about taking on all the issues that are to come, really.
And how difficult is it to do that if you've not really been used to dealing with the finances? I mean, I have to say that savvy woman users on the whole do tend to make most of the financial decisions in the household, and quite right so too. But I know that from other conversations I've had with David and with others who deal with couples going through divorce, that sometimes there is a situation where maybe the husband has been making most, if not all, the financial decisions. How difficult is it to then try and prepare yourself financially for divorce if you really don't have much idea of what's been going on?
I'm sure it's not a problem for most women listening to this program, but yes, I have personally had clients who, when they've split up from their husband or partner, struggle with even, you know, knowing what the bills were coming in. Sometimes the bills may not even be in their names, and indeed the house may not be in their names, and joint bank accounts, they may not have logins to those. So really, I think it's if you are in that position, start to think about all the things you would need to know, even getting logins and passwords for your bank accounts if you haven't got those, because lots of bank accounts are now entirely online, and so you need a password, and you'll need to spend 3 hours talking to your bank to get that sorted out, possibly, or internet access. Some people aren't used to doing that. And so get those sorted out in your head, or the phone numbers of where to go to. And then again, going back to budgeting, because it's really important to get a handle on that, you know, looking through what your utility bills are and what your bills are going to be, so you know who your utility bills are with, and how you can get access to money. And the other thing I would say, during the process of divorce may take longer than you think, and so you need to have access to money and cash whilst that process is ongoing and before it finalises itself. Otherwise, you'll have to start running up debts and credit cards. Now, talking on credit cards as well, if you haven't got any credit in your name and you're thinking of, you're not, may need a mortgage still ongoing after divorce, then you need to start thinking about placing yourself so your credit score is good enough to do that. So you may need access to credit. So just really start cleaning up your head on that, and looking at bills. And again, going back to really basic budgeting and knowing where your bank statements are, and just keeping some cash liquid.
And one of the things that I've covered through Savvy Woman that I've had quite a few emails about is joint bank accounts. And in particular, I have to say, I've certainly heard from a number of women who have had joint bank accounts with their husband, and where the husband has sort of either taken a huge amount of money out of the account or has asked for, got an overdraft and then gone on a spending spree. And I mean, obviously, I hear from women, so I don't hear the other side. But in the cases I've heard from, the women I've heard from, they've been the ones that have been pursued by the banks. So it can be quite difficult because things can move quite quickly, I guess. And especially if the split up is a bit acrimonious or isn't entirely good natured, which many of them won't be.
Yes, I think if you possibly can, I've actually seen this in live cases. What you need to, if you can put money, you need to have your own bank account really, and where you know you can draw from that. Because if there's nothing in there, you can't survive. You've got no income, no cash flow coming in. It's really, really very difficult indeed, and you'll end up spending all your savings. So if you can. If you know that it's going to be acrimonious, you don't trust the person you're with, then I would try and put everything in. Just make sure you've got your own bank account to avoid that kind of situation.
Or be aware that if the worst does happen and your husband does go on a spending spree, the bank is, well, likely. I mean, it's possible it'll just come after you for the whole lot if it has contact details for you, and that could be, you know, that could be a huge amount of money. So it is something to be wary about. David, slightly unrelated, well, sort of slightly related question that's coming in, but which is not so much about not having been involved in the finances through choice, but what can you do, and this is a question from Deirdre, what can you do if your husband is very secretive about the finances and actually doesn't want you to know about what's going on?
Well, certainly if there is to be a legal process, then both people will need to give full financial disclosure, which means that they'll have to set out in some detail all of their financial circumstances, and obviously including their income, bank accounts, etc., etc. So that's the first thing. There's a serious obligation on people to provide that disclosure. Now, of course, you know, from time to time, one or other of the couple doesn't provide everything that they should do. It's increasingly difficult these days. In the old days, we used to say to people, you know, have a rummage through the filing cabinet and see what you can find. But unfortunately, there's been some cases that have gone to the Court of Appeal in recent years that have said that secrecy actually still exists between husbands and wives. And so unless you've shared the financial information historically, you're not allowed to go and pinch it at the time of divorce. And if you do, you're not entitled to rely on it, and there's all sorts of complicated rules about what we have to do, or certainly complicated guidance about what we have to do if we get clients who bring in the sort of pile of information that they've pinched out of the filing cabinet, because we shouldn't even be looking at it. You can within a court process, of course, ask a number of questions which the other person can be compelled to answer, and you can sort of dig around. It's also possible, for questions to be framed on the basis of information that a party has seen, but it is quite difficult to rely on that information. It's not such a big problem actually in the bigger money cases, but the ones I sort of feel more anxious about, frankly, are those where there isn't very much money, because they can't spend in those circumstances a fortune in pursuing the other person and getting all of the financial information.
Well, that's what I was just thinking, that presumably, you know, if you suspect that your partner is hiding money or isn't being truthful about the situation, that does cost money to find out whether your suspicions are correct.
I mean, I have to say, these are a small minority of cases. Mm-hmm. Most people do disclose things, and actually, it's quite difficult to hide things. People really need to have planned for it for a very long time, so that there's no paper trail. Because, of course, as part of the disclosure process, you're entitled to see all of their bank accounts. You're entitled to see sort of historical tax returns, etc., etc., and you can ask all sorts of questions about it. So someone has to have been really clever and planned for quite some time to be able to hide it. Most people, as I say, are actually pretty honest, frankly. They do, you know, they might not enjoy the experience, but they do understand they've got an obligation to disclose. And of course, it's so much easier and so much cheaper if people do that, because then hopefully they can get to a financial agreement relatively easily. Where people do start messing about and not disclosing things, the proceedings can go on and be hugely expensive, and that only eats away at the capital that's available for the family. So it's not a good thing to do.
Well, we've actually had a question which is kind of on a related issue, which is Suzanne's just emailed in saying her husband has got his own heating business, which she's had little to do with, and she's worried that he will try and downplay its value when they get divorced. She's, I understand, looks like she's in the early stages. What can she do? I mean, if you suspect your husband or your partner may yeah. try and do that, is there something she should do now, or should she wait and see? What would you advise?
Well, there isn't much she can do at this stage. As part of any process, if there's an issue, a question about whether a business has a value, then often, certainly if it's part of a court process, what you'll have is an expert instructed, usually an accountant, to look at the company books, to do a bit of digging in to report on a value for the business. Now, not every business has a value. It really depends. I mean, for example, a law firm generally doesn't have a value. It's just seen as an income stream for the partners. So it's not the sort of business that you can sell on. But there are other types of business, of course, where people do sell them on. And indeed, you know, many people set up businesses with the sole intention of selling them at some point later on and making a profit. So if it is an issue within the process, you'd have an accountant appointed who would advise. Now, that in itself can be quite expensive. And so what we often do is actually, it sounds like it, you know, there's an awful lot of people involved, but what we'll often do is get a friendly accountant to have a look at the disclosure that's been given and to say, look, is this business likely to be worth anything? Is it worth us pursuing a formal report within, you know, the context of either proceedings or, of course, negotiations? There's actually quite a lot that accountants can glean from, you know, the business statements. So, you know, they'll either say, look, it's, you know, it's not going to be worth huge amounts, or yes, absolutely, you should pursue this. And then, you know, as I say, you'd have your independent expert report.
Okay. Sarah, you mentioned this in an earlier answer. You sort of mentioned a bit about the idea of getting a mortgage and getting yourself in a good financial position by applying for a credit card, so you've got that credit history. How easy or difficult, though, is it to get a mortgage, you know, particularly, say, where the husband might be the higher earner in the past, and therefore would have the mortgage would have been based more on his income? What should women think about, and where do they start?
Well, I have to say that mortgages are much harder to find. The finance is much harder to find now than it was, say, 3 or 4 years ago, for all the reasons, the credit crunch, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of many of the cases I see, the cases aren't large enough. There's not enough money in the divorce package for everyone to have a house owned outright with no mortgage and have pensions. So there's often not enough money to go around to provide everything for people that people need. So in many cases, therefore, the wife will need a house, and that might need mortgage funding on it. In some cases, I've seen where the husband has promised to provide a house for the wife. If that's not ideal, because then that requires the husband still to remain on the mortgage application till using his income to get finance on the house for the wife. So he's not an occupier of the property, but he's on the mortgage. So that's not ideal, because there's no clean break there. But that's one way of doing it. If the house does need mortgage finance, then that may be the only way to do it, though, unless the wife herself has an income of some kind. And it gets complicated, because the wife may have maintenance income.
I was just going to ask you that, yes.
But we can't necessarily use that off its own, and it might have to be in payment for a long time before we can use it in any event by way of a court order. If the husband's providing the income, then he's obviously got to take off the income, the maintenance he's paying to her, and then credit it back onto her as her income on the other side of the equation. So it is quite complex. If the ideal situation would be that the wife is earning, and so we can use her income for a mortgage, we can maybe top that up with maintenance, but it does have to be payable by way of a court order. It might have to be in payment for an amount of time, which won't be the case if it's just ongoing. And of course, the you know, the woman will have to have a credit score to get a mortgage now, because most mortgages are very, very much based on credit score. So if you haven't had credit in your own name, then it's good to try and have that on your score before you apply for a mortgage. So yes, that can be, it can all be very complicated at the current time.
And a credit score is basically where a lender will look at, say, for example, your credit report, but also take into account things like how long you've lived at the same address and whether you've had much change in your life, like changing jobs and things like that. And it's a variety of factors, and sometimes that can vary from lender to lender, but they will, as you say, definitely look at whether you've managed credit well in the past or presently. So if you haven't had a credit card in your name, then, as you say, that's going to make it difficult, or other credit indeed.
Credit scoring is quite a dark art. So you're right, it varies from lender to lender, and no one will tell you exactly what they're using. But in essence, what you want is a 3 years good address history. And if you've got some kind of history of bit, so if you were previously on the mortgage and have been paying, and that mortgage has been paid, then that will give you a better credit score if you weren't on the mortgage previously. So if you can make sure you are on the mortgage before you divorce, then that's better for you. And also that you can show utility bills, some kind of utility bills in your name, not just mobile phone bills. And if you have got credit cards that you can show you've been paying them, then that's all to the good, really.
Yep. And it doesn't mean that you have to go and take out a credit card and spend a whole load of money. I mean, you can just put a regular bill through your credit card that you would normally pay on through your bank account, for example, and then just make sure you pay it off in full every month. So it sounds a bit counterintuitive to tell people to go out and take out credit cards, but but you can manage it in a way that you get a regular payment that you already make, and that's all fine.
That's correct. In fact, nowadays, lenders are very, very precise on how much credit they're allowing you to have. So even if you are meeting credit commitments, if you have a lot of credit stacked up, a lot of bills, even if you're paying them, that is now detracting from people's ability to get a mortgage by having lots of credit built up. So we don't want to build up lots of credit, because that's bad, but you just want a card, and just to show you're regularly able to pay regular payments is what we want to show, really.
So okay.
Not lots of credit.
Now, David, you were talking earlier on about bringing in experts to, say, help with evaluation of a pension, or possibly bringing in experts to help value a business, and talking a little bit about things like the cost if somebody is being very secretive. Now, I know certainly that a lot of people worry about the cost of divorce, and I'm sure you come up against that as well. What are your tips for keeping the costs down?
Well, the biggest tip is don't fight, frankly. if when things get expensive, or when people fight tooth and nail and insist on, you know, going through a court process to get to an outcome, it's really not a very good way of doing things. You know, outcomes are uncertain, and it's hugely difficult, stressful, and expensive. So, you know, avoid proceedings at all costs. There are all sorts of really good and constructive ways of resolving things these days, whether it's mediation, collaborative law, or a number of other things. And I think the individuals need to do is to go in with the mindset that it's not about punishing their, you know, husband or wife who may have done something pretty awful. It's about getting to an outcome that hopefully is going to meet the needs of the family. Because if you go in with that mindset that you know it's about punishment, it's going to be expensive, undoubtedly. Of course, you know, it takes two to tango. And sometimes
it's obviously quite difficult if you feel that your ex, soon to be ex-husband, is, you know, playing all kinds of games. It must be quite hard to not want to do that.
It's very hard, absolutely. And what I always say to people is, you know, getting divorced is one of the most stressful things that you could go through. If at any time in your life you're going to get some professional support in terms of counselling, that's the time to do it. Because if you can get your anger and frustration out in another way, you'll be able to approach the divorce process in a lot more constructive and productive way. You do, of course, have situations where one person is just determined to fight, and that, you know, that's awful. That's, you know, it makes it very difficult for the other person, even if they're really trying to sort things out. And there isn't very much, frankly, you can do in those circumstances. But I think to give as much encouragement to each other to resolve things constructively, and, you know, think about the children, because. If there are children, because of course, you know, whatever happens between the adults, if they have children, they're going to have a relationship as parents for many, many years to come. So it's to try and focus on that stuff, and then often people do then find a way of getting to a solution without spending a fortune.
And I think it might be just useful at this point for you to talk us through the different options in terms of getting divorced, because, you know, I think a lot of people still think about the traditional kind, which is, you know, solicitor sends email to other solicitor and eventually, hopefully, some sort of settlement is reached. But there's also mediation and collaborative family law. So just explain what each of those are and possibly who they work best for.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's all sorts of ways of resolving things these days. Obviously, I guess the cheapest way is to sit round the table together and work it all out. But that's really hard for an awful lot of people because of, you know, I guess for obvious reasons. Another option might be mediation, is one of the ones you mentioned. What that would involve is the couple going to sit down with a mediator who's a neutral third party who obviously understands the law and the process of divorce. And what that person does is not advise either of the couple individually, but facilitate discussions which hopefully lead to an agreed outcome. The good thing about mediation is that it's relatively inexpensive because you've got one professional, the mediator, or two if it's co-mediation, but usually one mediator whose costs are shared. And what they'll try to do is to encourage the couple again to have constructive discussions, think about, you know, what they need, think about their children, and get to an agreed outcome. That process is entirely confidential and legally privileged, which means that you couldn't give evidence about discussions you have in mediation.
Okay.
And the idea behind that is that people will feel able to make concessions and to come to agreements that they might not do otherwise. You would always need to take that agreement to solicitors subsequently and get them to put it into a binding format, and the mediator will always tell you to do that. But you know, getting to the agreement is the hard bit, so implementing it and putting it into a legal format is relatively inexpensive.
I imagine some people would just be filled with horror at the idea of having to kind of be in the same room with someone, you know, if it is a very difficult divorce, and try and actually even have those conversations, albeit there's somebody neutral there.
Well, it's not for everyone, and certainly if there are significant power imbalances or, you know, a history of domestic abuse, for example, then mediation may be entirely unsuitable. Not absolutely so, because it still may be a better way of doing things than, for example, fighting it out in court. But you'd need, I think, as a mediator, to think very carefully before agreeing to see a couple where there is clearly those sort of historical issues. Some people who don't feel that a mediation is the right process for them because possibly of historical power imbalance might prefer something like collaborative law. What collaborative law involves is each of the couple instructing their own solicitors, both of whom need to be collaboratively trained. Rather than doing things in the traditional way that you spoke about, sending letters to each other and hopefully eventually getting to an agreement or not, what they do is do everything around the table. So literally from right at the beginning, you get the four people, the two lawyers, two clients together around the table to talk about, okay, you know, is this relationship ended? Yes. If it is, how are we going to divorce? What are the implications of that in terms of children, money, et cetera, et cetera? So it's done in a very constructive way. What's interesting about collaborative law is that everyone, and that's the solicitors and the clients, sign up to an agreement as to whether that they'll do things constructively, they'll act in the best interest of the family, and importantly, that they won't go to court. So if for whatever reason the collaborative process didn't work, and it was necessary to go to court, because of course, you know, the couple themselves always have that option, then they couldn't use those solicitors. So it sort of glues everyone to the table, and people really try to come up with constructive ways of resolving things. I think that's really important. Sometimes, I won't bore you with the details, but there's a discussion within the profession about whether the exclusion clause is important. I'm absolutely clear that it is, because how otherwise you can't have really open discussions. If you're, you know, in the back of your mind, those solicitors might go off and be fighting for or against you in court. You're not going to be able to have the sort of discussions that are really needed for a really good collaborative process.
And is that becoming more popular? Are more couples thinking about using things like mediation and collaborative family law, or not really?
Yeah, I think more and more people are. Certainly we're doing, my firm, a lot of mediation and collaborative law. I think people don't want to spend money these days because there's less of it about.
Fair enough.
Very sensibly. Yep. So, yeah, you know, they want to, and these processes, whilst not necessarily cheap, are going to be a lot cheaper than fighting it out in court. So people are interested for that reason. I think people are also sort of wising up, really, to the impact of fights on, you know, on them and their children. And so people are wanting to find processes that do enable them to get to a constructive result. You know, it is happening more. And of course, there's been a big government push to get everyone into mediation.
Yes, indeed. While we were just discussing that, David, we've had a question come, which I think might be more for Sarah. It's from Amber. It's a question about the credit score. Basically, she said, if I divorce my husband, would my credit rating instantly improve? Now, there's a reason why she's asking this. She said that her husband's company is closed, not bankrupt, she says, but her credit rating is still affected by this as she was a named director, although she had a small input to the company. And therefore, at the moment, it's difficult to get finance. Would that help, or would that in and of itself not actually necessarily help her own situation?
It won't necessarily, it won't be an immediate, to change your credit score isn't, as I say, it's vague how these are done, and it varies lender to lender, but just by being divorced won't actually improve your credit score. It was always done against your name and address, so you would need, so if you haven't been, so for example, you're bankrupt, you would need, you know, significant, it's still possible to get your score up, but you're going to need several years of history of good payment. But it certainly is not helping being associated with him, I don't think, from the sounds of it. But it's not going to be an immediate improvement.
Yeah. I mean, on a sort of general sort of starting point for the credit reference agencies, I mean, normally if you have a financial connection, which is often something like a joint loan or a joint mortgage, then your credit files will be linked, and unless you break that financial connection, which you have to actively do. So if you are, you know, if you still have a financial connection, even if you've got, even if you split up, sometimes there can be an effect on your own credit history, and you actually have to make sure you contact the credit reference agency if you've been able to split that connection and, you know, not have joint loans and joint bank accounts or joint mortgage, and tell them, you know, we don't any longer have that financial connection. I mean, just one tip, I don't know whether it would be of any help, but possibly Amber could put a notice of correction on her credit file and explain the process, and just say that, you know, this was my input in the business and this is my situation now, and that might possibly help, because at least lenders would have to read that before they made a credit decision. But yes, it certainly doesn't sound like he's helping your credit score in any way by the sounds of things. So in terms of other questions, sorry, I just lost my track slightly. I've got a question here for you, Sarah, which is actually about school fees, which is an interesting one. If you have been paying school fees jointly, you know, you and your husband, what are the options? How can you sort of set up a pot after your divorce to make sure that the school fees are paid?
You can either, it depends when if the fees are currently being paid, then I have seen cases where the couple set up put the funds in a cash account, and they draw on that, and that's earmarked for the children as part of the divorce proceedings going forward for the school fees. Another small tip that I actually have seen done as well is if the child, in one instance, the son was already at the senior school, and it was possible in that case to speak to the treasurer or so of the school, and they were able to pay off in the future all the fees up to age 18 with a lump sum, which was actually there was a discount on that, so they got a discount.
I can imagine there was.
Fees up front. Yeah. So that caps the cost of rising fees. So it can be done that way if there's enough cash to do it. Also, if you don't trust the person with a joint, with access to joint funds as well, because I have seen problems there, and I referred to it earlier, people taking
money
out.
Might be a way of protecting, making sure that money actually goes where it's supposed to go.
Yeah, so in that case, it was possible to pay the fees up front, and it was quite a substantial discount, obviously, as you'd expect, on doing that, and there was no risk to inflation on the fees. So that's one way. If you're trying to save, it's incredibly hard to save for school fees because they're quite a lot of money. So generally, it is paid out of income as part of the divorce arrangements. But you could try and set up if it's for a very young child, you could try and invest the funds, make a regular payment to invest them for a future date. But if the fees are already needed, it'll either have to come out of income. Or a cash account might be set up to pay for extra tuition fees like music or sports clubs and so on.
Okay. David, one of the things that I know has come up whenever I've written about prenups is is how unromantic they are. They may not be romantic, but are they ever worth having? And if they are worth having, who are they A, sort of useful and B, affordable for?
They're certainly worth having in certain circumstances. They're not particularly romantic, of course. But most people don't like thinking about them at the time that they're embarking on a new relationship, and hopefully one that's going to be a happy one and last a very long time. But nonetheless, it is something that people are doing more these days. It's usually, I have to say, either where there's family money, so you've got one of the couple that's inherited a lot of money that's been in the family for some time, or you've got an older couple who've both been married previously. So those are the sort of people that generally do them. They are worth doing because although they're not technically binding in England and Wales, a court will hold a couple to what they've agreed in a prenup, provided they each had legal advice and financial disclosure, and provided they knew what they were doing. As long as the consequence of holding them to it is that it doesn't deprive someone of their needs. So if you've got a woman with children who's agreeing that she won't have any capital and won't have any maintenance, then that's going to be entirely unenforceable and frankly ignored. But if you make provision that provides for needs and exclude everything else, then that's perfectly permissible and very much likely to be followed by a court.
And the difference between a prenup and a postnup, and do different people, is a prenup useful for some people but not for others, or are people thinking, well, actually, maybe our situation has changed since we got married and now we want a postnup? Just explain the differences.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just perhaps stating the obvious first of all, a prenup is obviously prior to the marriage, a postnup is subsequent to the marriage. The postnups often come about where people feel that their marriage is some financial difficulty and one person, for example, wants some financial security, i.e. they want to know that if things do go wrong, that they'll be financially secure. So people in those circumstances will think about whether to have a postnup. Postnups in law are treated pretty much exactly the same as prenups. So there's no legal difference when it happened. They're likely to be followed again, unless it puts one person in a situation where they can't meet their needs.
And do you see, have you seen an increase in interest in postnups? I mean, prenups seem to have got a lot more publicity over the last few years, partly because of a couple of high-profile cases. But have you seen any increase in postnups, possibly because of people, you know, sort of the situations people find themselves in, or are they still something that most people just don't think about?
Most people don't think about them. As I say, they only tend to come about. Well, I've said, you know, where marriage is in difficulty. That's the most common situation where they arise because, you know, and someone wants financial security. I'd say the other situation is, of course, where you've got a prenup, because often you'll agree as part of the prenup that you'll review whatever you've agreed in X years' time.
Of course, yes.
So then, of course, what you have then is a postnup. So there's those cases, because if you have a prenup and never look at it again, it may be that, you know, if there is a subsequent divorce 20 years later, that the financial situation envisaged when you had your prenup is something very, very different to what it is at the end. And in those circumstances, the prenup isn't going to be given as much weight as if it was created with, you know, the sort of situation that is in mind.
And Sarah, we're coming back to one of the questions one of the areas we get a lot of questions about, which is pensions and divorce. A basic question in a way, which is that if you are given some money as a result of a pension sharing order, so where the pension is divided at the time of divorce, you can't just take it and spend it, can you? You have to, or use it to buy a house or things. You have to use it, basically put it in a pension or stay in the pension that's being divided. Is that right?
That's right. So I would normally get called in at this stage where there is a pension sharing order, which means that the court have said that an amount of money needs to get transferred into the other party's name, so usually the ex-wife's name, and used as a pension. So if you imagine a pension being a cash or investment with the pension wrap around it, that's dictating how that money can be used. So with a pension wrapper, we know we can't use it, we can't access it before age 55. You can take 25% tax-free cash from it, so it has to go into a pension, another pension policy. So you need to then go probably to a financial advisor and look at how you want that money invested. And then it's back to the basics of how you would invest the money, really, which is how old the person is. If you're only looking to invest it, if you're 30 and it's going to be invested for 30 years, then that's a relatively long term. So you might want to look at putting it back into, you know, unit trust, stocks and shares, or, you know, equity-based or backed funds. And if you're much older and you can see the end date on that fund quite a short distance away, then you might put it in, if you can imagine inverted commas, less risky funds or bonds or cash even. But when you get to 55 or 65, when you're taking that money, the same pension rules apply as if the money had been yours from the start, which means you can only take 25% of it as a tax-free lump sum, and the balance has to be used to buy you an income for life in some format, usually using an annuity. But
and I'm assuming that dividing pensions, particularly if it's one that's based on someone's salary, can get pretty complex in terms of working out the worth and what actually provides an equitable income for somebody.
Yeah, so when you're valuing your pension pot, so if it's a pension pot, personal pension plan, it's quite easy to work out the value of that pension because you look online or you phone them up and ask them what the value of that fund is. In a divorce case, if the fund is on that date $250,000, then I would normally recommend that money is moved, that the husband moves that money into cash or whoever's money it is, just so we know it will be $250,000. When it's finally transferred out, because otherwise it could fall in value, couldn't it, in that time?
Good
so there
point,
was a question
yeah.
there of whether the people are happy to take. So one case I was speaking to, I think the court had agreed that it was worth X, and it's actually worth. So she said, I can afford to. It wouldn't be less than X $100,000 that he would transfer across. In which case, we decided to leave it in funds and hope that it might be more. Because worst case, he'd put a. There was like a full point on it, so. You know, worst case, it wouldn't be less than X, but it could be invested, left invested, and would be worth more. So it's either the actual value or, worst case, he was guaranteeing a minimum amount. But generally that doesn't happen. So generally I would say belt and braces, and the money should be in cash. Now, it's not always possible in that situation for to get the person whose pocket is to move it into cash. But I would say that would be helpful if it could be done, so everyone knows exactly what they're working with in terms of values. If it's something like a final salary scheme where your pension is based on each year you've worked, then you won't have a pot like that. What you'll have is a value of what your pension will be, which might be, I don't know, £1,000 a year. So then you're working, you probably need an actuary to work it out, because you're saying if the pot would be giving £1,000 a year at 65, what would that value of that fund be? It would have a, which you could work out what you would need to provide that kind of income out of date in the future. And then you wouldn't need that money today because it would have grown in the meantime. So you discount it back to give a cash value today. And that's a cash equivalent transfer value or transfer value. And that is the amount that would come across. So it's supposed to represent the amount of income that's been promised to the other party. But
it does sound like, I mean, we get a lot of questions, and I know I pass both, you know, you get both lots of questions on, you know, divorce and pensions and on how pensions can be split. And so I can see that it's not as simple as just looking at the value of the house, as you said, David, I think very early on. I just want to sneak in one quick question before we end, which is a question from Lily, who says that she is divorcing her husband on the grounds of unreasonable behaviour. So, David, this is one for you. Wants to know if her husband's behaviour would be taken into account in terms of working out who gets what.
Okay. What's
the answer?
Short answer to that is no. we've got a ridiculous system of divorce law in this country where until you've lived apart for at least 2 years, and I'm talking about England and Wales, you have to rely on a fault basis in terms of divorce. That's either behaviour or adultery. In terms of civil partnership dissolution, it can only be a behaviour petition. Actually, most petitions are fault-based because most people don't want to wait until they've been apart for a certain amount of time before getting divorced. But the court doesn't and isn't allowed to take into account the reason for divorce in working out the money. So people take a pragmatic view. Whenever, certainly I'm drafting a behaviour petition, for example, I'll tend to use things that are pretty mild and as inoffensive as possible, although it's still necessary to allege fault. And the other person in those circumstances will understand because they're told that it's just a means to an end and will allow the petition to go through. So, no, it's not something, in short, that she needs to worry about. If there are issues that are relevant to money or children, then that argument could be had somewhere else. You certainly wouldn't want to have it within the divorce process because it is really just a paper exercise of getting you from your married status to divorce status.
Great. Well, look, thanks very much. That is all that we've got time for today. So thanks for all the questions that came in and for listening. A special thank you to David Allison of Family Law and Partnership and Sarah Killick of Independent Financial Advisors, FPW. There's lots more information about divorce and relationship breakdown on Savvy Woman, or you can always submit a question via the Ask the Expert panel. So join me for the next webinar.